I was also on that trip, and there were a lot of incredible moments when he was outside of the monastic environment. He was essentially on vacation for maybe the second time since I'd known him. But I feel more like talking about the last year of his illness before he stopped speaking. And I went back to Thailand about 4 years after I disrobed, and I didn't know anything about the illness until I spoke to Jack before I was leaving, and he told me that, but I think it was just when I arrived in Bangkok that somebody told me he had surgery, and he was staying around Bangkok with Ajahn Prabhakar as his attendant. And at that time, I finally found him, which was quite an undertaking. And he had slowed down a lot, but he was still pretty much the same old Lumpa, just moving slower. And occasionally, you could see he was just too exhausted to talk to people, but. I would go up to Ubon to the forest monasteries and then come back, pass through Bangkok every 2 or 3 months. I'd have to be renewing my visa and leaving the country. And so I would go to see him. And the second time he was in quite poor condition and could to just barely talk and focus, and it was quite alarming or shocking or sad to see. And then I'd go back a month later, and he'd be all bright-eyed and full of beans and making fun of me again, and so I knew he was feeling better. And then the next time he'd be not so well, and then they had said he needed about 6 months to recover from his surgery, and then I think I saw him just about 6 months, and he just seemed like the old Lumpa, and it was a kind of dreamlike quality to all this, that he would be so different every time, and you'd wonder, you know, what was really going on, and was I remembering things right from the last time I saw him? And this time in Bangkok, he was just luminous and very relaxed, and it just felt very nice to be around him. It was a very happy feeling, just like none of this illness was a problem anymore. And then he prepared to go back to the monastery, and then he went downhill again, and so I went ahead to the monastery, and then he came a couple of weeks later, and he was in very bad condition. I think he never really bounced back from that one, and then shortly after he stopped talking, and then is when the royal family's doctors came up to see him and asked to bring him to Bangkok for thorough examinations, and so when I was leaving, so I saw him there at the hospital in Bangkok, and remember him coming out of the room, and he had to be supported when he walked, and you weren't sure if he really knew who you were or was really focused on anything that was going on around him anymore. And having done hospice work, I thought, you know, he's got the look of a dying person, and probably, you know, a few months, a year at most. And I was leaving the country, so It was very heartrending to think I was never going to see him again, and probably I would never hear his voice again, because it seemed like he'd stopped speaking. And then, of course, he fooled us all by living for almost another 10 years. And I visited a few times over those years, and mostly just it was paying my respects to his body. And they would wheel him outside, and the monks, Ajahn Basano would take the monks to go do chanting in front of him. And I mean, you saw his body, but it was hard to think that this was Ajahn Chah. Yet he, and at one point they say he has cancer, he'll be gone in 6 months, and he has this, he has that, and famous psychics were doing predictions, and the best doctors in Thailand, 6 months, he'll be gone, and he stayed around. I didn't go to see him all that often. I felt like Ajahn Chah was more in the forest, in the monastery where I was staying. He was there in the practice, and it wasn't all that necessary to go see his body every day. And I think that's probably the way he would have preferred it. I always thought of him as somebody with another trick up his sleeve, and it seems like the way he lingered on was a great gift of training to people. The Sangha came together amazingly, and monks learned to be nurses and round-the-clock care, and doctors came out every morning to check his vital signs. And they built a special kuti for him. People made enormous donations, and it felt like this last training he was giving people. And he'd often spoken, what will happen after I die? How are you guys going to practice if I'm not here to remind you? And I think there was a sense among many of us that things wouldn't hold together, that people just weren't that committed without Lumpo around to goad them and, shame them into not disrobing. And those last years, I think it brought the Sangha together in a very major way and kept people on the ball and working together and serving the Master in a very devoted and a very touching way, very touching. And as a lay person coming back with sort of new eyes, the whole thing was very touching. Just seeing people offer food to monks, because after when you're a monk, after a while you just come to expect it. Here I am, where's my food? This is, you expect it every day in a country like Thailand. And then you go out and you have to earn your keep, and you want Thai curry? Okay, go to a restaurant and a couple of dishes and rice and tax and tip, and you're out, $20 or something. And hey, in Thailand, I used to turn these things down, which you'd be in Bangkok, you have bags and bags full of curries. Well, which one will I choose today? And now you can barely pick two, and once every month, maybe, or every few months. So to see people offering this kind of generosity, and the way the lay people came to the monasteries, and the way that monasteries were open, it was all very moving. The last few times I saw Ajahn Chah, it was all a very moving thing, and you wonder, what was he up to? when this was going on, I kind of see it as his last teaching or his last gift or trick or whatever, so I'll pass the microphone.